iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeart Radio app, Rachel goes rogue. For the first time, she's ready to tell you the real story on her own terms. What's true, what's false, and the secrets she's been waiting to reveal. Two Jersey J's. From menopause to making the most of your 40s and 50s, follow these fabulous women as they navigate family, friendships, and even frenemies. The Eds. There's so much more to the Eds than being married to Real Housewives. These two gentlemen are loved and well-mannered, quite the opposite of their trash-talking wives. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Game, Criminals and Libertines in the South. And I am your host and lifelong wayward woman, Dr. Lindsay Byron. Listen to Hooker Gay, Criminals and Libertines in the South on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Martha Stewart, and we're back with a new season of my podcast. This season will be even more revealing and more personal, with more entrepreneurs, more live events, and more questions from you. I'm talking to my cosmetic dermatologist, Dr. Dan Belkin, about the secrets behind my skincare. Encore Jane about creating a billion-dollar startup. Walter Isaacson about the geniuses who changed the world. Listen and subscribe to the Martha Stewart Podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On March 24th, 1984, five children and their mother, 28-year-old Elva Lupercio, were killed in an apartment building fire. It was originally ruled accidental, but a fire captain who was on scene, unofficially, may have had some reservations about that finding. Then, in November 1987, a man named Dwayne Glasgow, who lived nearby the 1984 fire, was arrested for burglary and offered some information that back in 1984, looking out an attic window, he had seen his old roommate, James Kloppelberg, walking back and forth to the building before the fire and later admitting to setting it. And then, in December 1987, while coincidentally reporting an unrelated arson, James Kloppelberg was questioned about the 1984 fire and allegedly gave an oral confession in January 1988. Even though allegations of coercion shed doubt on the statement, testimony from Glasgow and the fire captain were enough to send James away for six natural life sentences, plus 14 years. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. This is an arson case. I hate arson cases. I think it's one of the worst of all the junk sciences. It's also a torture case because the man we're going to be speaking to was just another victim of the torture crew in the Chicago PD under Lieutenant John Burge. And before I even introduce James Kloppelberg, I'm going to first reintroduce somebody who our listeners will probably recognize, Carl Leonard. Carl is an attorney at the Exoneration Project in Illinois. So, Carl, welcome back to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, James, I'm sorry. I feel like the city of Chicago, Illinois, the country, everybody owes you an apology and more. But I'm so glad you're here and I appreciate you being here with us today.
My pleasure and thank you for having me. It's a true honor.
James, before we get into the awful occurrence that happened in Chicago that led to the deaths for which you were years later wrongfully convicted, your life wasn't easy from the beginning. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that would be a fair representation. I had a low-income childhood, so to speak, with three sisters and a brother and my mother. We moved around a lot. I think at one point, probably about once a year for like a decade-ish or so growing up, I remember going to a lot of different schools, almost a different one every year. And things were tough, you know, as far as finances and everything. But for the most part, my mother always made sure there was food on the table and we were loved and taken care of.
By the time James was 18 years old, he had been married, and during a rough patch, he was temporarily staying with his friends, Dawn Graymont and Dwayne Glasgow, who lived about four doors down from where this fire occurred a few weeks later. The couple had their own troubles, along with two kids and another one on the way.
On February 16th of 84, she gave birth to her third child, and Dwayne took her to the hospital, and I was staying over. So I watched their other two children. I got a phone call from her that evening. He had not returned yet. And she asked if I was still looking for a place to stay. I said, yeah. She said, well, you can move into the bedroom up in the attic. You want to help me out with the bills? Fine, whatever. I said, well, what's he going to say about this? She said, I don't care. That's the catch. I want you to pack his stuff. I want him out. Apparently, while she was giving birth to his third child, he was in the waiting room with his girlfriend and a gym bag with some beer, kicking back, having a good time. The nurses told her what was going on, obviously. And so when he came home that evening, his stuff was packed, and I told him, there's the door. She basically dumped Dwayne because of things that weren't working out between the two of them. Me and Dawn ended up starting a relationship.
Somehow, this didn't cramp your friendship or theirs, right?
Well, that was the thing. A couple days before the fire, he had came back knocking at the door, asked to talk to her. She came into the kitchen. She's like, he's got nowhere to go. Can he stay upstairs? I'm like, this is your house. Because by that time, obviously, I'd moved downstairs. I said, this is your house. If that's what you want, fine. And so he was actually staying there in the upstairs where I was originally staying. And I was gone all day that day the fire occurred. I was at my ex-wife's house taking care of things over there. Came home that night. They were him, his girlfriend, and Dawn. They were fairly intoxicated. And several hours into the night, you know, me and Dawn had some arguments. And I entered and left a few times to cool off and came back in. And we were sitting around the kitchen table talking. And next thing we know, we see this fire. We got the kids out of the house, put them in my car. The fire went on for several hours.
Carl, if you could take us back and explain what happened on that awful, awful night. This was back in 1984, March 24th. I mean, whether it was arson or not, we know that James had nothing to do with it, but this was a tragedy.
It was a tragedy. It's an incredibly sad case. It happened early in the morning. There was an apartment building on the south side of Chicago. The first floor was vacant. And a fire started on that first floor, and there was a family that lived upstairs, seven people in the family, a husband and wife, five kids, and the fire unfortunately killed the mom and the children.
28-year-old Elva Lupercio and her five children, Santos, Sonia, Cristobal, Yadira, and Annabelle, all of whom were living on the second floor, died, and her husband managed to escape. His name was Santos, but he suffered a fractured skull and severe burns.
So just a terrible, terrible tragedy. At that time in Chicago, fires were investigated by the Chicago Police Department. It had a bomb and arson unit, which was in charge of investigating suspicious fires. And they did an investigation and concluded that the fire was most likely an accident.
Testing for the presence of accelerants came up negative, closing the case as a tragic accident. Not a crime. Until November 1987, when Dwayne Glasgow was arrested for burglary, theft, and violating probation, and he brought up the 1984 fire. According to Glasgow, he had watched through an attic window as James went back and forth to the building right before the fire, and that James later admitted to setting the blaze. Meanwhile, back in 1987, now 22 years old, James was a plumber and electrician while moonlighting as a security guard. He and his girlfriend Bonnie had plans to get married. When, in December 1987, coincidentally, a month after Glasgow's statement, James reported an actual arson while working at his security job.
One of the apartment complexes that I was assigned to, an automobile caught fire. I saw somebody running from the parking lot that night, and a couple police detectives came to see me. I was at a job site, and they said they needed me to look at mugshots. I said, sure, no problem, but it'll have to wait till I'm done. I'm in the middle of one of the worst winters Chicago had had in like forever, and I was thawing frozen pipes at this building. They informed me I was going with them one way or another. They took me to 11th and State, informed me that there was a witness that claims to have saw me start the automobile fires, but that he couldn't get down there for several hours because he was at work. If I wanted to go home now, all I had to do was take a polygraph test, prove that I didn't do it, and they'd let me go. I said, sure, no problem, let's go. They take me to another floor inside a dimly lit room. It's soundproofed. A gentleman says he needs me to sign a waiver, and I was barely able to make out that it said that I was about to be questioned for a fire concerning six deaths in 1984. I told the examiner that this is the wrong form, that this is not what I was here for. I said, I'm not signing that. and he stepped out of the room. The detective that brought me down burst into the room, threw me up against the wall, put a pair of handcuffs on me, drug me upstairs, and him and his partner then proceeded to beat me for next several hours.
So you were one of the countless victims, suspects, as well as some witnesses, who were brutally tortured inside these Chicago PD torture chambers disguised as interrogations.
Yes, they laid me face down on the ground while one of them pulled my cuffs, my arms towards my shoulders. The other one proceeded to kidney shot me or continued to beat me in my lower back area until I started hemorrhaging blood through my urine. I urinated myself. There was a lot of blood in the urine at the time. And I uttered the words, "I did it," and they stopped the beating.
I mean, you probably would have confessed to the Kennedy assassination.
Truthfully, yes. At one point, they wanted me to sign a confession. And an officer removed his weapon from his holster and said I was going to sign it or else. And I said at that point, he might as well just go ahead and pull the trigger because signing it would be the same thing.
Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison. Now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and leave us a message. Tell us how these powerful, often tragic stories make you feel. Outraged, inspired, motivated? We want to know. We may even include your story in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app, Rachel goes rogue. For the first time, she's ready to tell you the real story on her own terms. What's true, what's false, and the secrets she's been waiting to reveal. Two Jersey J's. From menopause to making the most of your 40s and 50s, follow these fabulous women as they navigate family, friendships, and even frenemies. The Eds. There's so much more to the Eds than being married to real housewives. These two gentlemen are loved and well-mannered, quite the opposite of their trash-talking wives. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Game, criminals and libertines in the South. And I am your host, Dr. Lindsay Byron. 3 years ago, I came across a goldmine of news clippings detailing a scandal that rocked my small southern hometown. As I flipped through each page, this forgotten story came back to life.
I was told that it was just supposed to be a massage parlor.
The big shot in Davos was Barker.
He beats me continuously.
If you print anything that you hear in the grand jury, you will be put in jail.
I never gave any massages.
Listen to Hooker Gay, Criminals and Libertines in the South on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Martha Stewart, and we're back with a new season of my podcast. This season will be even more revealing and more personal, with more entrepreneurs, more trailblazers, more live events, more Martha, and more questions from you. I'm talking to my cosmetic dermatologist, Dr. Dan Belkin, about the secrets behind my skincare. Walter Isaacson about the geniuses who changed the world. Encore Jane about creating a billion-dollar startup. Dr. Eliza Pressman about the five basic strategies to help parents raise good humans. Florence Fabricant about the authenticity in the world of food writing. Be sure to tune in to season 2 of the Martha Stewart Podcast. Listen and subscribe to the Martha Stewart Podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The way it works is after the police have gotten the soon-to-be defendant to the place where he or she is saying what they want them to say, they'll oftentimes rehearse it, and then they bring in the felony review state's attorney, who take a statement from them, and at the end, they ask the person to sign. And then that's often the last time the soon-to-be defendant ever sees the outside of a jail cell.
The state's attorney wanted to take my statement I started to give him a statement, basically saying I did it. I told him that I needed to talk to my then girlfriend. He allowed me to make a phone call to her. She made a three-way phone call to my then attorney. I told him what was going on. He told me to put the state's attorney on the phone. They had a brief conversation. State's attorney slammed the phone down, went out to the hall, told the officers to process me, not to speak to me, not to touch me, and to get me out of there. A couple days after the beating, on my intake, I was so badly beaten that the Cook County officers wouldn't turn a blind eye to it, and they actually documented all of my injuries.
The state's attorney, I mean, he had to know that you had been tortured. There was no question, right? And Carl, what do you think he was thinking at that point in time?
I have no idea, but I think that the mechanism they use in Chicago, in Cook County, I think is very unique, where we bring in an assistant state's attorney, a prosecutor, to take the actual statement. And I think the entire felony review system is designed to sort of inoculate against allegations of torture and abuse by the time you get into court. Because there were so many people claiming, a lot of them truthfully, that their statement had been beaten out of them, you put a lawyer in the room who has a law license on the line, who can then come to court and say, look, I'm just a lawyer. I didn't see anything wrong. And I don't know what was going through this particular state's attorney's mind, but it may have been. There's no way I can go to court and say that nothing bad happened here, so I need to protect myself.
Nevertheless, Cook County sought the indictment in January 1988.
The officer that presented the case for the state at the grand jury outright committed perjury. One of the jurors had asked him why I had done this at the completion of the state's presentation, and he replied that it was my pattern that when I got mad at my girlfriend, I went out and set fires. Another juror then asked, so he had been caught for this before, and he replied, yes. The only problem is I had never so much as been questioned for an arson fire in my entire life, let alone caught or convicted.
So on January 27th, 1988, James, you were indicted on charges of arson and 6 counts of murder.
Actually, 18 counts of murder.
18 counts.
They charged me 3 times on each victim, along with 7 counts of attempted murder. My entire indictment, I believe, was around 31 counts.
But the well-documented evidence of torture shed doubt on James's statement to officers and the state's attorney.
When my lawyer put on a motion to suppress my statement due to the abuse, and the judge granted it because of the abuse was so blatant, the state's attorney stood up and said, Your Honor, are you also suppressing what he told the state's attorney that night? The state's attorney didn't beat him. And I just sat there and I was just stunned into amazement that he swore up one side and down the other I wasn't beaten. And now he was basically conceding I was beaten, but that what I told the state's attorney should be allowed in because he didn't beat me.
Pretty freaking devious.
Well, you have to keep in mind the judge that suppressed my confession got removed from my case after suppressing my confession because he went against the system.
Wow.
Within 2 weeks of that, Judge Loretta Hall Morgan was assigned my case. And it didn't register really at the time, but the judge who was going to be sitting at this bench trial already knew about my confession because it was part of the record that it was suppressed.
And this doomed bench trial finally began in July 1989.
The state put on 6 witnesses, 2 people that they call life or death witnesses that said that we survived the fire, the family was alive when we went to sleep, woke up to smoke and fire. They didn't implicate me at all. They put on a medical examiner who said that, in his opinion, the cause of death was smoke and fire, carbon monoxide poisoning, and that the manner of death was homicide. When asked why he originally said there were accidents, he said that's because that's what he was told by the police, and that 4 years later, the police told him that they wanted to charge somebody, and he had to change his death certificates to homicide. They then brought a gentleman in from the Chicago Fire Department who was there that night as an observer, who was training a class for a future fire investigating team that was going to take over fire investigations in Chicago called OFI. He testified that due to burn patterns, he was positive that this was an arson fire, but yet he told nobody. for 4 years. And the reason that the state used him as a witness, in my opinion, is because he filed no reports. So there was nothing to impeach him with. Whereas the original officers who investigated the fire that said it was an accident, they would have had to have went back on their original report. And then they put on Dawn Graymont, who was my girlfriend at the time, who told the truth that I had nothing to do with it. They then proceeded to impeach her with a grand jury statement that she made that after making it, she went to the Office of Internal Affairs and said, I was just forced to commit perjury in front of the grand jury. And then they brought Dwayne Glasgow in, who gave the testimony that he gave in exchange for going home the next day. My attorney presented no defense whatsoever. At the end of the state's case, he stood up. He asked for a directed verdict of not guilty. The judge said motion denied. He said, oh, well, the defense rests, and he sat down. And the judge said she was going to take a 10-minute break to have closing arguments. She took a 10-minute break, came out, and found me guilty. My lawyer just sat there.
No closing arguments?
There were no closing arguments.
Wait. Carl? Help. What the fuck is he talking about? No closing arguments.
It doesn't make any sense. So many things about James' trial don't make any sense.
Right. Well, what happened was, like I said, she took the break. We came back, and I was expecting closing arguments. And she sat down and started reading her findings, and I'm looking at my attorney like, what's going on here? And he's like, don't worry about it, it'll be okay. And she said, as to counts like 25 through 31 or whatever it was, or 24 through 31, those are the attempt counts. There's going to be a finding of not guilty because there's no evidence to indicate that the defendant intended to harm those individuals. As to the remaining counts in the indictment, there's a finding of guilty. I was, for want of a better word, I was just in shock. I mean, I couldn't believe that she had found me guilty. I was just dumbfounded at the fact that if a person was guilty of this crime, how could they have been not guilty of attempting to kill the people that jumped out the windows and lived, but guilty of killing the people that perished? It wasn't like this was a crime with a gun or a knife. Fire is indiscriminate. If I had set the fire, I would have intended harm on everybody in the apartment building, not just certain people. Her verdict held no sense to me whatsoever. And then she so nonchalantly, after finding me guilty, she literally said the words, gentlemen, what's your pleasure? And it was at that point that the state's attorney stood up and said, Your Honor, at this time, we'll be asking for the death penalty.
Gentlemen, what's your pleasure?
That's what she said.
What's your pleasure? As if this is some sort of sick game. I don't even have the right words for this. So they asked for the death penalty.
The next step, you have to have a hearing. And it took me a couple of days to process what had happened. And somebody else who was incarcerated awaiting trial at the time told me that I needed to get down to the jail's library, the law library, and speak to somebody down there because what was happening wasn't right. And that's when I found out a lot of things. You know, I found out that I was actually able to demand a jury for the death penalty phase because I didn't want her to make that decision.
In case this story isn't crazy enough, there's a crazy footnote to this whole thing, which is that on October 7th, 1989, while you were awaiting sentencing, you had walked out of the Cook County Jail after bond records were altered to lower your bond from no bond to $25,000 and your mom posted $2,500 in cash. And then the jail officials discovered that a jail employee had been bribed with $3,000 to alter the record. And then you were arrested days later and brought back. What in the world? Again, I've never heard anything like this before.
What you're speaking of holds some truth to it. I don't recall as to what my ex-wife actually did for the jail official that altered the record, but nobody was listening to me. I was going to be put to death for something I did not do. And so, yes, I bonded out. I was hoping that while out, I could probably get enough notoriety to the case to where people might look into it and see the errors that were committed. Technically, I was arrested, but I actually called them and told them where I was. They were making threats against my family that if I did not come back, they were going to take it out on them. So I called the state's attorney and told him where I was. It was not my proudest moment in all of this. But again, when somebody's talking about taking your life, and after what I had already been through with the beatings and everything, and what I had seen happen to this point, I didn't know what else to do.
James was back in Cook County Jail in November 1989, where he began all kinds of proceedings, trying to save his own life, including demanding a new attorney and a new judge.
When it came time for my sentencing, I had requested to remove my attorney because I did not feel that I was being represented in a manner to save my life. The judge denied the request, so I went to the Attorney Disciplinary Commission and said that I'd given my attorney a large amount of money to hire investigators and things like that, and he did nothing. He never came to see me. He never spoke to me, at which point my attorney notified the judge that he was under investigation by the commission and that she had to let him out of the case. She wasn't happy about it. At that point, I also moved to remove her as a judge because she was not giving me what I felt was a fair shake, so to speak. One of the things that I had alleged as to why my judge needed to be removed was because she had made a statement after the first day of trial. She had said something like, "I start my vacation the day after tomorrow. This case is going to be done tomorrow regardless," or something like that. And I was just trying to build some type of a record for appeal of what was actually happening to me. And she finally, after that motion was denied, she finally appointed a public defender. And that's when they found the evidence that Dwayne committed perjury by saying he said he saw the back door of the building, that he saw me enter and leave the building. They obtained evidence that photographically shows it was impossible that he could not have seen the building. They tracked down people who used to live in the buildings from years ago that before that had said, "No, there's no way you could see from point A to point B." And even faced with all of this, the judge refused to correct her mistake at a motion for a new trial.
And here it was, March 22nd, 1990, when somehow James had escaped the death penalty.
Yeah, the reason she rejected the whole premise of the death penalty was she wanted me out of her courtroom. Here we were almost 8 months from my conviction, and she still had been unable to sentence me because of court filings and things that I was trying to do to save my life. And she literally asked me what was it going to take to get me out of her courtroom. And I said, I did not want to fight this from death row. She said, "Well, the only other sentence I can give you is natural life." The sad reality of it is, had I known then the things that I know now, I probably would have accepted the death penalty due to the fact that I think I would have been out sooner.
Well, you would have been entitled to an attorney for post-conviction, which you're only entitled to if you are sentenced to death. The judge rejected the death penalty and sentenced you to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
6 natural life sentences and 3 14-year sentences.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app, Rachel goes rogue. For the first time, she's ready to tell you the real story on her own terms. What's true, what's false, and the secrets she's been waiting to reveal. 2 Jersey J's. From menopause to making the most of your 40s and 50s, follow these fabulous women as they navigate family, friendships, and even frenemies. The Eds. There's so much more to the Eds than being married to Real Housewives. These two gentlemen are loved and well-mannered, quite the opposite of their trash-talking wives. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Game, criminals and libertines in the South. And I am your host, Dr. Lindsay Byron. 3 years ago, I came across a goldmine of news clippings detailing a scandal that rocked my small Southern hometown. As I flipped through each page, this forgotten story came back to life.
I was told that it was just supposed to be a massage parlor.
The big shot in Danville was Barker.
He beats me continuously.
If you print anything that you hear in the grand jury, you will be put in jail.
I never gave any massages.
Listen to Hooker Gay, Criminals and Libertines in the South on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Martha Stewart, and we're back with a new season of my podcast. This season will be even more revealing and more personal, with more entrepreneurs, more trailblazers, more live events, more Martha, and more questions from you. I'm talking to my cosmetic dermatologist, Dr. Dan Belkin, about the secrets behind my skincare. Walter Isaacson about the geniuses who changed the world. Encore Jane about creating a billion-dollar startup. Dr. Eliza Pressman about the five basic strategies to help parents raise good humans. Florence Fabricant about the authenticity in the world of food writing. Be sure to tune in to season two of the Martha Stewart Podcast. Listen and subscribe to the Martha Stewart Podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I went to Joliet. I was there maybe 4 weeks at most, and then I was sent to Menard, where I spent the next 10 years of my life. They call it a pit for a reason because it was literally built into the side of what was an old rock quarry. Finally winning a transfer out of that hellhole, I then did another 4 years almost in Joliet before they closed it down. I was then transferred to Stateville. I did almost 10 years there and was transferred back to Menard for my last 11 months where I met Carl for the first time.
Over the course of two long decades, James's direct appeals and his first post-conviction petition were denied. And then, when he was about to file a federal habeas, the Exoneration Project got involved, filing a second post-conviction petition in 2009, including expert testimony from a Dr. Ogle, disputing the fire captain's trial testimony that was based on an ancient and now debunked arson investigation method. For clarity, listen to our coverage of arson investigation on Wrongful Conviction, Junk Science. We're going to have it linked in the episode description. The Exoneration Project was also able to bolster their expert with previously hidden exculpatory evidence.
We haven't talked about that there is an alternate suspect, that there's somebody else who was setting fires in that neighborhood at that time. Doing some research into media coverage of fires in the neighborhood at the time, law students Ashley Schumacher and Cadence Mertz uncovered a small neighborhood newspaper that had run an article with a headline something like, "Who's starting these fires?"
Amazing.
The night before, if I remember correctly, the fire at issue here, there was another fire that had happened, which the police, the same police, investigated and determined that the fire was set by a woman who lived in that building, Isabel Ramos, because she was mad at her landlord about something. So she decided to burn the place down. And in the course of questioning her about that fire, they said, "Hey, what about that fire down the street? Did you start that one?" And she said something, I don't know what her exact words were, but basically, "I was really drunk. I set a lot of fires. How can I remember?"
They pulled the court file and her original confession from her trial was still sitting there in the court file.
And none of this is disclosed to the defense before James' trial. And we filed this petition. There was also a habeas petition, which was in front of Judge St. Eve here in Chicago. And she was not able to advance it because we had the pending state court matter. But there was an opinion entered by her agreeing to stay the habeas petition because she felt that there was potential merit to it. So in the state court, we proceeded towards an evidentiary hearing to present the new evidence.
And one other little side note, after my evidentiary hearing was granted on April 15th of 2010, the state said they needed time to obtain an expert of their own to review the fire science evidence that Carl and Gail and everybody had put together with Dr. Ogle. It wasn't until a few years after I was released that a document accidentally got turned over to my legal team that said that the state's attorney had for a full year in their possession a report that basically said what Dr. Ogle had said in his report for me. And they were steadily going to court telling the judge they needed more time because they couldn't find an expert to look at the evidence. So for an entire year, they held me knowing that what was said by Dr. Ogle was true, that this wasn't an arson fire.
And right before we were supposed to have this hearing, the state determined that they would no longer oppose post-conviction relief.
They chose to act 2 weeks after Dawn Graymont died. She was in hospice. They went to her room. My ex-wife was there that day that they showed up and tried to get her to give a deathbed statement that I was actually guilty of this. within 2 weeks of her passing is when my court date was, that Carl and Tara went into court that day, and the state just said, nah, you can let them go now. But that's how unwilling they are to admit when they make a mistake.
They went to her in the hospice.
Yes.
I don't know what to say anymore. But I do know that finally, Circuit Court Judge Ricky Jones vacated all your convictions, and the charges were dismissed. And on May 31st of 2012, after a quarter century in prison, you left prison.
I met Carl for the first time on the day he came to pick me up. And it was one of the most surreal parts of my entire life, because we walked out and Carl had told me how it was raining the whole way down there. And we walked out of prison and it stopped. It was the weirdest thing.
I will never forget that day. James was the first person I was with when he walked out of prison after being exonerated. And it was really exciting to be part of that with James.
Because of him and some extremely dedicated people, I have a new lease on life.
And as I understand it, not that this dampened your mood as the rain was lifting, but you walked out with $14.17, right?
Well, it's all I had on my prison account at the time. And because I was no longer a convicted felon, I was not entitled to all the benefits that a convicted felon would be given upon their release. Had Carl not come pick me up, I had no way to get back to Chicago, because I wasn't even going to be afforded the bus ticket, the opportunity for housing assistance. I mean, it was the exoneration project that put me up in a hotel. All the things that a convicted felon receives, I was afforded none of it.
Yeah, they literally kicked you out the door. But the good news is that in May 2013, you filed a federal wrongful conviction lawsuit against the city of Chicago and the Chicago PD. And even in a case as egregious as yours, it took, what, almost 5 years to get compensated, right?
Yeah, it was almost 6 years. But what was filed first was a certificate of innocence request. Because in Illinois, you have to have one of those before you can move forward really doing anything. Which meant not only did I have to prove that I wasn't guilty, but Carl and his team had to prove that I was actually innocent. So they obtained that for me on August 5th of 2013.
After a contested hearing, the very same state that agreed that James was innocent enough to come home fought us on the certificate of innocence.
Finally, you know, some daylight in this now almost 30 years by the time you were compensated, this long, long, dark chapter. So that is a happy ending. How's your life now? I understand when you came home, you were living nearby your son and daughter-in-law.
It took me almost a year to find my first job. One of the worst moments of employment seeking came the now defunct Kmart Corporation. They were going to hire me to do maintenance in one of their warehouses in Illinois. When I got in there to fill out my paperwork, in the middle of it, the human resources woman asked me, what happened to all this gap in my work history? I said, didn't you read my resume? Because my resume stated from the onset, after being wrongfully convicted for 25 years, I'm now re-entering the workforce. She started reading it. She made some gasps and some oh my's. She got up, she left. She came back and she said, I'm really sorry to have wasted your time, but we don't hire convicted murderers. I said, but I was exonerated. I'm innocent. Yeah, but you were convicted. I'm like, but I didn't do it. She's like, but you were still convicted, so we can't hire you. And I was just stunned at that point. I was like, well, you know, I didn't know if this was ever going to end. To this day, I have no Social Security because there's no way for me to be out long enough to work long enough because of my age to qualify for Social Security. So when I can no longer work, I'm pretty well screwed, because even though I did receive compensation, the money that I did walk away with, which was about $2 million at the end of it, you know, is long gone. I do have my house, thankfully, that's paid for, and my vehicles. But when I get too old to work, I'm really not sure what's going to happen, if I'm being totally honest. If somebody wants to hear me speak, somebody wants to hear about my story, I'll go wherever, whenever to try to enlighten people and open their eyes to what has happened in the system. I am part of the program for the Police Training Institute that has been initiated in Illinois, where there is now a mandatory 4-hour class in Illinois for every police academy class that goes through, where an attorney and a couple exonerees and the project director go to each class and spend about 4 hours with the cadets. The class is on wrongful conviction, avoidance, and awareness, where we get to speak to these future police officers and hopefully open their minds to what can go wrong.
Well, we'll have some way to contact you linked in the episode description for speaking engagements. And additionally, maybe what you were talking about earlier should be the call to action this week. We need to be building ramps, not walls, for folks like James to re-enter society. We need legislation to provide exonerees with the same things that are available to parolees. I mean, it's a no-brainer. And I'm glad that we're bringing awareness to that once again. And with that, we're going to move on to closing arguments. First of all, I want to thank you both for being here today and sharing this insane story. And with that, I'm going to turn my microphone off, kick back in my chair, and leave your microphones on for anything else you guys want to say. Let's start with you, Carl, because we always save our honored guest for last. You're an honored guest as well, don't get me wrong, but our featured guest, of course, is James. So, Carl, over to you, and then just hand the mic off to James, and he'll take us off into the sunset.
Well, first, just thank you for this show and all the work that you do to give people like James a voice that was taken from them for a very long time. And I think it's important that we get to hear their voices now. I think James has obviously not had an easy life before or after getting out of prison, but he's done an amazing amount of work to help himself and help those around him. He's advocated on behalf of initiatives to change laws in Illinois to avoid wrongful convictions in the first place. And not just in Illinois, he's worked on this in many states. So I'm glad that this episode will air so people can hear about James' story and not just the part of the story that's tragic about the fire and what happened to that family and what happened to James, but about who he is now. So I'm honored to have gotten to work with James. I'm honored that he's still someone that is in my life who I see from time to time, who I text. He's a great guy, and I'm glad that he has this opportunity to tell his story.
Thank you, Carl, for that. I mean, you constantly downplay how important you are and the things that you do.
That's enough.
But true to begin with. And, you know, a lot of people talk about good people in this world. And when you start thinking of people like Carl Leonard and Tara Thompson and Gail Horn and John Lovey, the reasons that they do what they do, I like to call the right reasons. Because they save people. They save people in ways that we as average citizens don't think of. When we think of people saving people, we think of firemen and police officers and things like that and who step in the instant. You do it for the right reasons and you do it selflessly. I mean, with your family and the sacrifices that they make because of the time that you're not spending with them, they're just as important and just as special. I have no idea how many hours of his life he gave to give me my life back. But it's a debt that no matter how many times he tells me I don't owe him anything, I'll never be able to repay. Because I wouldn't be here talking to you guys if it was not for people like him and Tara and Gail. And I don't think that anybody realizes just how special these people are.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
iHeart Podcast. update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app, Rachel goes rogue. For the first time, she's ready to tell you the real story on her own terms. What's true, what's false, and the secrets she's been waiting to reveal. Two Jersey J's. From menopause to making the most of your 40s and 50s, follow these fabulous women as they navigate family, friendships, and even frenemies. The Eds. There's so much more to the Eds than being married to Real Housewives. These two gentlemen are loved and well-mannered, quite the opposite of their trash-talking wives. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Game, criminals and libertines in the South. And I am your host and lifelong wayward woman, Dr. Lindsay Byron. Listen to Hooker Gay, Criminals and Libertines in the South on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Martha Stewart, and we're back with a new season of my podcast. This season will be even more revealing and more personal, with more entrepreneurs, more live events, and more questions from you. I'm talking to my cosmetic dermatologist, Dr. Dan Belkin, about the secrets behind my skincare. Encore Jane about creating a billion-dollar startup. Walter Isaacson about the geniuses who changed the world. Listen and subscribe to the Martha Stewart Podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.